it can feel very invasive, I think, to be asked such personal stuff. And most of us know we don't go around talking about those kinds of sort of, people say, heavy, deep, underneath kinds of issues. And yet, I never was refused. In fact, quite the opposite happened. Eyes would light up and they'd say, yes, I'd really like to share that with you. And I decided that what I was doing somehow is initiating in a gentle enough way that I didn't scare them off, and that I experienced there to me a tremendous amount of what I call healing power in the act of initiation itself, and not only that, but then in the ensuing conversation. So that's how I came up with that title for this paper that I gave. So today's session will be on this topic. I'd like to try to unpack that in the sense that I work at a funeral home. My work is with bereaved people, doing outreach to them. And so part of outreach, I think, it has to be knowing how to initiate to people gently, because all of us know that when we are in grief, most of us don't have a lot of energy to reach out ourselves, and we need to be reached out too. And there's a real delicate balance between asking someone to talk to you or share information, where it feels like you're being interviewed, and where the person approach feels like they're being interviewed, or where they feel like you really care about them. So that's another part of what this title means, is that I think to initiate gently is to convey to someone else that you really care about them, and this is not just a one-time shot to get some information. Some of you that have been to some of my other sessions know that this is the way I present and this is the way I teach. I'm out of an educational model. I'm a teacher. I am not a therapist. And so I personally find that a very inviting way to do this kind of work. Because a lot of people are afraid of therapy because it sounds like they're sick or something. And actually it's quite the opposite. People that are healthy go into therapy, I think, to try to get more healthy. So the way I present ideas is with images, and some of you may know there's a lot of research, a whole body of research about the healing power of images, and that has come through over and over again in the themes this week. Peter Steinke talked a lot about that we have images programmed in our reptilian brain from the time we were small children, and Jesus taught in images and metaphors, and so I really believe that a big part of healing is to reintroduce ourselves to new healing images and listen to our images that come out of our own lives. So I'd like to introduce this topic today by some of the images that I'm going to be dealing with. And one of them is, I think, to be involved in this whole process of caregiving or outreach to people, initiation, is to be participating in the mystery of death and resurrection, the mystery of the cross. So this is evocative of that kind of a concept. So sometimes when I'll teach in the Shalom groups, and I've got many brochures here, some of you are interested, I will just present an image, and I'm just going to lift up several of them today. I would never have all these on the centerpiece at once. Also, I think we are angels. I'm an angel collector person, and I really believe that God sends people into our lives, and sometimes we are that person to be sent into another person's life at a time when healing is needed. And to be a gentle initiator is, I think, to be an angel in someone else's life. Another theme I'm getting at here is in this card, a friend is a present you give yourself. I really believe, I've experienced this over and over again, that when I reach out to someone, it's maybe selfish, but no, not really. It's a mutual giving and receiving, because you wouldn't do this kind of outreach unless you cared about people, I'm sure. And then in the reciprocity, you get new friends. And I have done a lot of initiation work with people in my community who I didn't even know, but at a time of loss, I felt it was my call to initiate to them. It also involves a tremendous amount of listening. This is the prophet Elijah from the retreat center in Minnesota, the Ark. Gentle initiation involves really being attentive to the other person and listening and not having a big need to fix or come in and be heroic to that person. It's also, these are some of my images of what Bonhoeffer calls in his little book, Life Together, the roses and lilies of the Christian life, which is Christian community. And this is a card I just got from a very good Irish friend of mine. And when she sent me this card, it just captured in images the essence of our friendship, which is another creative way to image community. Also, I believe what we are participating in when we do this kind of initiation work is being planting seeds. That, you know, at Holden, of all places, I feel this sort of journey concept when you're forever meeting and saying goodbye to people. And that's how life is at home, too, that when we meet people at a time of need or when we are in a time of need, it's seeds planting, and God gives the watering and the increase. Another Abby Press card that I love, a faithful friend is a sure shelter. Whoever has found one has found a rare treasure. And in grief work especially, if you are that person that sticks with another, hangs in there for the long haul, which will be what my session will be on tomorrow, it's real concrete ways on how to do that, that is very rare. It's a very rare treasure. I do design cards there in the bookstore here, and I'm going to talk about this kind of stuff in terms of card later. But just to plant a little idea for tomorrow's session, if you're the kind of angel, initiator, friend who initiates by card sending many months, weeks, days after the death, for instance, we're talking about loss through death in this series, believe me, you will be one of the rare people, because all of us send cards at the time of the funeral, and you're inundated, you don't even have time to read them, and then the mailbox looks pretty empty. So I learned that out of my own grief situation with my mother having lost my brother and my father to cancer in a very short period of time, that it's what is needed in healing grief work, which is gentle initiation, I believe, is to keep coming way long after a lot of us keep coming. And that's a ministry, I really believe. Not everybody's called to that, but another image is that we're participating in the feast. My image of the kingdom, the reign of God, is the feast. And I think that comes, see, I recognize that in myself at Holden too. I get real sad going to that bus and you just get to know somebody and then they go away. And so my image of the feast comes out of having two family members of mine lost through death early in my life. And then moving, our family is nomadic. because my husband's a pastor. So out of those situations in my life, one of my yearnings for the reign of God is when we will all sit at a feast that will never end, and everybody will be there that I've ever loved, and I think this captures that. And so participating in this kind of outreach to people, I believe, is creating little bits and pieces of that in this life. Our lives are shaped by those who love us. Another theme I'm going to be dealing with today is that all of us, and I'm sure you could tell many stories, and by the way, let's keep this informal, and at any time you'd like to chime in, please do so, that we all can remember the people who came and kept coming, and we have been bereaved. As I mentioned last week, I still remember the color of casserole that my friend Linda brought over when my brother had died, and we were early college, and my friend Linda was the kind of person that would never have known what to say, but that's not what's important. Because our words are not what's important. It's our physical presence, and our lives are shaped by that. We feel alone or we don't feel alone to the degree that people are physically present. And last week I talked about a little bit about Bonhoeffer, again his book Life Together, where he talks about the powerful bodily faith we have. We have a very physical Christian faith in the life of Jesus, who was born as a little baby, grew up in a little boy's body, and grew into a young man who was crucified. In the body, we believe he rose in the body, and therefore we too shall have a new body. And when I read that, I immediately related that to healing grief work, because if you don't get your body over to see somebody, they will think you don't care or something like that, because silence is almost always interpreted as indifference. And in grief, we probably, most of us feel like this at any given time in our sit. In whatever grief it is, why and how can I make meaning out of this? And so to gently initiate is to participate in healing in the sense that you are a gift. So throughout today's session, think of yourself that as a gift, that you come in a great big gift package that's brightly wrapped, and whatever your unique gifts are will be a gift to somebody else in terms of healing power.
Yeah, you know, backing up to your comment about being inundated with cards mm-hmm. at the time of a loss, and how important it is for something like that to happen later on, Do you think that maybe people are really hesitant to send cards, you know, 2 or 3 months later, a card, because they think they will be surfacing that hurt for you again, and therefore, you know, don't do it, because they think they're doing you, would be doing you a disfavor by surfacing
that. I'm sure that's real possible. Maybe, has anybody ever had that feeling here, that if you send a card 3 months after the funeral, that you'd just be resurfacing something? I'm sure that would be a feeling, although the tape that we'll probably see if we have time toward the end of the session today is interesting. The woman on this tape said that very thing, that sometimes she's been very forgetful, or not forgetful as much as her good intention, she just doesn't do it. Doesn't send the card at the time of the funeral, and then her husband will, she'll say, well, I think I better send it. And he said, no, don't send it now, it's too late. And she said, for many years, I listened to that, and finally I thought, no, I'm going to send it anyway. And then people would say, thank you so much for that card. It really meant a lot to me. So I think that may be a feeling some people have, but I would say, for one thing, it's inaccurate because, for one thing, it hasn't gone away in 3 months. It's still very, that's when you need them more than ever. Some of you are shaking your heads. And it does, contrary to the myth in our culture or wherever in our psyches that somehow grief goes away, it never goes away, so it's never too late. And in my card ministry outreach, which I've had for 20 years, I have people on my list that I send to years afterwards, like just once a year, just so they know I still remember them. Yeah.
Contrary to our common way of dealing with grief, I read somewhere, and I don't know how true it is, but among a certain segment at least of the Jewish families, that the subject of conversation to someone who had lost someone in death of that must always be for a year first to talk about the loss.
Yes. Jewish people have wonderful built-in rituals in their tradition that we should all learn from. They have the year of Shiva, which is a year of mourning. And you wear black in public, so you'd go to church, and if we all wore black, if we'd had a death in our family, then it's kind of permission for everybody to come up and say something to you, maybe, you know. Whereas in the Protestant traditions I've grown up in anyway, you know, you sort of have this church lunch, and then you go home, and then you're supposed to get your life together, and life goes on, and then what happens, and correct me if you don't agree with this, that so often I will hear people say, let's pick on church coffee hour as the place where this happens. So say you've had a death in your family and you come to church the next Sunday or two Sundays later, and you might smile to somebody, or you're not crying, and people will say, my, aren't they bearing up well, and they are so strong. Or then even a month later it might be, well, they must be getting over this really well. And people that I work with, it comes out over and over again in groups, all say that those are stoppers, absolutely. For one thing, it's all erroneous. That is not the way it goes. And I wish we had more permission to just cry at coffee hour or circle or wherever, church, wherever you are, because then that's how we're feeling inside. But somehow there's a strange thing that happens to us when we go to church. Sometimes I even, Holden breaks that down, because at least we don't wear our Sunday best out here. You know, when you go to church, everybody, it's sort of like a play. Everybody dresses up to look great. It's kind of like putting on a mask, in a sense. So I think, quite contrary to those concepts, the opposite is true. And we should encourage one another to cry as a sign of healthy grief.
Can I share one of your cards? It just occurred to me, I bought one of your cards today. In fact, three of them. For use for just this very thing. I lost my father in March. And I saw this card of yours that says, lift us up, Creator God, that we may see further. Cleanse our eyes, that we may see more clearly. Draw us closer to yourself, that we may know ourselves to be nearer to our loved ones who are with you. And I thought that next March I would send one of these to my brother and two sisters with a note in it, just reminding them and sharing with them the anniversary of our father's death.
Thank you. That particular card came to us 3 years ago when my husband's youngest brother was killed by a bolt of lightning as he was a youth director at a church camp. And that was a prayer from a priest that was my favorite card. It reached me more than any other, and I had it in my refrigerator. And finally, when I was designing my own cards, I thought, I'm going to make that into a card because it meant so much to me. So the anniversary of the death is certainly a time, like you were saying, thank you for sharing that, to send a card, but many other times too. Any other comments at this point? Okay, thank you. Just keep adding as we go along. Okay, I'd like to go on now, after sort of highlighting the themes here, to get into just a quick few little comments from this research paper I did. And I believe that what I was really doing, I didn't realize it till after I was going through the process, and it was sort of nearing the end of having to put the paper together, that what I was in fact doing was inviting each person that I talked to into community. And as some of you may have been to some of the earlier sessions I've done, that is really one of the themes, the thesis of what the work I do, is that I really believe community is the way we are healed. Peter Steinke's talked about that, Rob Wall. It's been the theme in all the sessions I've attended the last 2 weeks, that we are not healed clinically, ultimately. We are healed mysteriously in the body of Christ, and that can only happen through each other. Christ is incarnated in us. And so my passion for this kind of work comes out of my own life story and how I know I was healed and have seen my mother and others of us in our family healed through death. When I do the Shalom groups, as this little brochure is about, is I really believe it's an invitation to people to come into community over their loss issues, death through death. Now, I'm not even dealing with all the other loss issues in life like divorce and loss of health, job, etc., but for purposes of focus. And then people will say, oh, you must get really depressed doing this kind of work, or it must take a lot of, and it does take a lot of energy. But mysteriously, we receive energy from God by being in touch with our pain. Elizabeth O'Connor writes a lot about that, that we, if we stay in touch with our pain, it will lead us to our bliss. And that's the way of the cross, as I understand it. Now, I'm not a theologian, and I cannot make it sound like it makes sense. I don't understand it, but I believe it's true and I experience it. Okay, so briefly about this paper that I did. What I did is I asked 6 questions. Now, these are people in my hometown community who had lost their first spouse either through divorce or death and had come together in a second marriage and were blending children from both first marriages into a new family. And I was asked to research and present some ideas on this topic at the funeral home convention. And I decided instead of reading other people's research and books, I would do my own, which is more fun anyway, I think. And I'm having a lot of fun out here videoing people's stories, which, by the way, is an invitation to any of you. If you have a story you'd like to share with me, I've got my video camera and lots of extra tape, and I'm on off hours here finding people under trees and doing some videotaping, so I'd appreciate that. But the 6 questions I asked in the interview process were, 1, for you, what were the initial loss and grief issues that surfaced as a result of your separation crisis? 2, who were the children involved in the remarried family and what were their issues? 3, as partners in the new marriage, what issues did you struggle with or carry with you from your former marriage? That's the unresolved stuff. 4, what other issues surfaced as spin-offs of your grieving process and remarriage? 5, what kept you going, gave you hope, and helped you heal during the time of loss and in the days of rebuilding your new life? And 6, what did you want from me or would you now want from me as a person working in follow-up support after the funeral or during this time? Okay, those are the 6 questions I asked the people. And here are some clues and observations from the interview process itself. 1, without exception, eyes lit up with interest when I approached the subject and asked for an interview. Instead of going, you know, resenting me for asking, they went, oh, yeah, I'd like to talk about that. Another clue was that I asked for an hour of time, and most ended up asking me for more time. Said, well, don't worry about the time. Let's just keep talking. In one case, one couple came back to me at church coffee hour the next Sunday and said, could we talk more? And they had a list of issues they'd gone home and had surfaced after talking that they hadn't talked about for a long time, so we had another hour. And another clue is everyone expressed deep words of appreciation for my listening time and for asking me to interview them. I started noticing this in every case, and I thought, this is amazing. So those were the clues. Now, what I'd like to do is skip over to the part where what I did, and this was a real powerful part when I was presenting it, I just simply said, in your words, I didn't have a tape recorder, but I was writing. I asked them if they would give me permission to just jot down what I was hearing them say. And I asked them if they could just say, what to you is grief? What has been grief about the situation? Then I said, what has been hope? Hope is, and then what do you want from me in terms of a person that's reaching and caring, reaching out to you? So I'm just going to read a few of these quotes to you, which will give you some ideas. Grief is filling in the missing gaps. It is loneliness. Grief is moving and being new in a town when the death occurs. Grief is going to a lawyer to file for divorce, even though our marriage had been dysfunctional for years. Grief is struggling through painful issues that are not addressed or named in the public arena or among friends. Grief is my obsession with my stepdaughter who hates me and resents losing her dad to this other woman. Grief is my stepson who just won't come around anymore because he hates me. Grief is my once close relationship with Lisa, my daughter, now tainted with my stepdaughter's enormous load of anger, hate, and unending pain from losing her own mother that she brought with her when she came into our family. My daughter lost a part of me because now I am also a stepmother. Grief is being honest about the mess I'm in. Most days I say it's better than loneliness, but there are many days when I want my old life back and I'm sorry I got into this. Grief is the energy spent swimming upstream constantly to try to make this all work. Grief is my daughter's words, Mom, I don't like it when you dress Nick like Dad. Grief is aching for my pastor to come to me as well as to my husband and our children or to take us all together and be neutral. This is a divorce. Did he avoid me because he blames me? That's what it feels like. Grief is having no one to grieve with us as we separate. Well, you can hear in there themes from divorce, themes from stepdaughter, stepmother situations. And the reason I think this is so important to talk about is because we're living, if we're not in it ourselves in a situation like this, these are people in our congregations, and there are an enormous amount of grief issues that are not being addressed by the church in most cases. Now, if you have a church, how many of you here have a grief group in your local congregation? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, that's about a right percentage. And I mean, that's about the way it is. And one of my strong convictions and passions is, wouldn't it be wonderful if the church could be naming people's issues? If the church could have places for people to talk about their issues. This has come up here at Holden. Several people I've talked with about it, you know, over dinner or whatever, have said, you know, our church does a very good job. We have good preaching. We have a good Sunday school. We have a youth department. You know, all the normal things that we probably all have. But we're not dealing with people's issues in terms of this kind of stuff. And over again, when I work with people, they say, I can't talk about this in church. Okay, I've got many more, but for purposes of time, I'm going to skip over to hope and a few things that people said hope is. Hope is advocating for a cause so that hopefully I'm helping to prevent deaths by drunk drivers. Mad gave me that channel. This woman's husband was killed by a drunk driver. Hope is gaining new self-confidence and friends through my involvement in Mad. Hope is knowing that my faith is strong. It's my lifeline. I think it was there before, but now I know. Hope is being so powerless that I had to let God handle my life. Hope is finally not having to have the answers. Hope is friends who love me. God loved me through my friends to prove that I was worthwhile. This is divorce. Hope is my friends saying to me, you're not alone. Hope is the resilient human spirit. Hope is moving to a new community to build a new life. Hope is being able to talk openly to my sixth grade daughter about her fears and guilt. She wonders if loving her stepdad means that she really didn't love her dad. Hope is respecting our past lives with our first spouses and letting them walk among us. Hope is my commitment to our new relationship, letting my partner know about my life, struggling through the hard times and the decisions made daily to make it work. Hope is the 12-step program. many, many more, but you get the idea. Okay, now, let's see, where is the section? Anybody want to comment about that? Those kinds of comments. See if I can find the section on what they want from me. Okay. Here are a few quotes on what they want from me, which is what they want from all of us who are caregivers, who are angels to be sent to people who need help, like we all do. Okay, after two intense hours of conversation by my fireplace one evening, Nancy, my friend, said to me, "It is so," and I have about 15 O's after the S because that's how she said it, "so wonderful that you are doing this." And Nancy, who some of you may have seen last week, was on the interview with the blended family, who had a very difficult time putting two families together, and never has really a chance to really talk about it. Karen said, "Do you know how healing it is to have you ask me with a listening heart how it is with me? No one has asked me that during this painful time of separation." This is a situation where if a couple got divorced, and both, you have some of these in your church maybe, or you've maybe been involved in it yourself, where it's like they switch partners, and they just decided to marry the other partner, and they all go to our church. Well, there's a lot of shame and guilt and realigning of friends, and so there we all are in the parish, and it's real funny what happens in those situations, and no one had ever asked her how she was. She went on to say, "Listening with your heart is vastly different than information gathering." Jan said, "I would have given anything to have had someone like you who knew what I was going through to talk to at the time of my husband's death." This is the woman whose husband was killed by a drunk driver. "I want a warm, approachable person. I need you to initiate to me. Send cards, don't call." Now, of course, that's not always true, but that's one reason I really believe in card ministry, because the telephone is so much more immediate, and a lot of times people will say, if they get a phone call, and someone will say, "How are you? You feel like you better be okay," unless you really feel comfortable with that person, and you even stuff it on the telephone, because maybe if someone calls you and says, "How are you?" and they know you've had a loss, and for you it's been 5 months, you think, "Well, I suppose they think I should be fine, so I'll tell them I'm fine." So, "I have no energy to reach out, so I need you to do that to me. It's later on, like 6 months, that I need you. Ongoing long-term friendship. I need you to let me be where I am in my own process. My young children need to go on as normally as possible. My teenagers need the same things I need. Our culture does very poorly in helping us deal with our grief issues. From you, I need time and opportunities to get in touch with my feelings. I can't ask you for help in grief. You need to ask me." Okay, those are just some comments. And another, I always, pick up things in Newsweek, the paper, whatever, and put them in my file. And this is one, this happened to really touch me. I know that Pan Am crash last Christmas. I don't know why, but sometimes certain incidents that happen in the world really get inside of us. And this one really got inside of me. Because I think I was imagining myself being a mother waiting for my child to come home from college and receiving that kind of news at the airline ticket counter. So I cut out this particular article in Newsweek. Was excellent in terms of what it surfaced about one of the teachers of life, which is extremely difficult tragedy to deal with. And I'm going to highlight a few of those issues simply because in the movement of this hour, we have some tremendous obstacles to deal with if we want to do healing initiation. And one of those is that we often mean well, but we don't get around to doing it. How often do we say to each other, "Oh, let's get together now"? and then if we say that to someone else, which has happened to me, I get my hopes up and I think, "Oh, good, they're going to invite me over." And then they may never do it. And I think, "Well, what does that mean? Didn't they mean it?" And then I've done it many, many times myself. So I try to shut up now and not say it unless I really get the calendar out and put the pen to the date. But people in grief especially need to be followed through on that. Or we don't know what to say, so we say nothing. And like my friend Patty and Val, who were on the tape a couple days ago, they were both widowed at a very young age, at age 30-something, and they each had three kids. And Patty, or Val, said she'll go to her church, and when someone comes up to her, "I didn't realize this would be a stopper," but she says, they'll say, "Val, you look just great." And she said, "To me that means I don't feel permission to say, but I'm not great," unless you blast through and say that to someone anyway. So oftentimes we avoid people that we know are grieving because we don't know what to say. And I believe in all the reading I've done in terms of Christian community, that, because I know this is true myself and with the people I work with, that we are creatures who long for Christian community, but we're afraid of intimacy often, and especially around issues like this. It's been interesting teaching this subject out here, because several times last week it happened, people would come and say, oh, is this about death? Oh, forget it, I'm not going to stay for this. Or people will say, oh, that's such a heavy topic. But what really happens in the groups or in this kind of ministry is it's life. It's life in death, which is the theme of the week of Embracing Contraries. Okay, just quickly about this article from The Cruelest Kind of Grief was the topic of the article. The chaplain said that when he went to the desk and heard the news, he was honest enough to say he couldn't enter into their pain and say, I know just how you feel, because he didn't. And he just let them scream and howl, you know, and swear and whatever all they were doing and run outside. That the tragedy, this kind of tragedy, does not grow back easily together. And you can think of tragedies in your own community that may be just like this in terms of its suddenness, its violence, or whatever. And that there are terrible jolts that still lie ahead. And I really appreciated the honesty of this article, because what happened then, if you maybe remember this from reading it yourself, or maybe even know somebody involved, there was a very similar tragedy by another Northwest flight from Detroit to Phoenix, and everybody that had been left as a survivor went to the airport to meet this group of people who had had this tragedy. Now that is community, because they did know what that was like. And they came, and then they were very honest in terms of telling them what was going to come ahead, and awful things like going to the morgue and trying to find body parts, all these awful, awful things. And then toward the end of the article, it said that the second year the survivor from this first plane crash had said, it wasn't until the beginning of the second year she realized that that really hit her, because in severe grief and trauma, oftentimes the first year is coping, sheer coping. And then the reality starts hitting the third, sometimes second and third year. And I thought what I'm leading up to here is that the end of the article said that sometimes in life, in these kind of situations, we have to accept that a part of us will always be sad, this big gaping hole that we're left with, and that we want more than anything to have that back, but we can't have it. So if that's happened to you or people that you love, then it seems to me the only alternative is to invite that person, to invite yourself into a healing community where you can start to heal from that. Okay, any comments, any other things you want to say?
I've just been thinking a couple of things, because every time I attend a session like this, I hear that people don't ever say anything because they don't know what to say.
Uh-huh.
And as I think more and more about it, and this has been a process I've been kind of evolving during this hour listening to you talk, I don't really think that's it.
Uh-huh.
Because I think we all know that we could simply go up to somebody mm-hmm. and say, really, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to hear about how things are and how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's simply all you need to do to get them started. And I think what the real problem is there's two things I can really think of. I think one of them is that it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to be able to have some sort of a little in-person card, like some sort of a little phrase we can say and a pat on the back and go, there, and I hope I helped you. Goodbye, see you later. And that, it just isn't that way. And so it takes time. Our lives are really, really busy. And it's like you're entering into a commitment, you know, and you kind of wonder, you evaluate whether you want to do that. And I think the second thing is that most of us are probably afraid of the sort of feelings it'll bring up in us.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I guess I never put words to those thoughts mm-hmm. until right now, but I don't think it's really that we don't know what to say.
I think it's all of the above. I think a lot of people don't do it because they don't know what to say, but I think what you've said is absolutely right on, too. And I've dealt with that in the other sessions, and it comes out in the tapes, but that's just a quick little blurb on why I'm doing these kind of groups. And I don't think you've been to the other sessions,
no,
have
no.
you? Yeah. some of the themes that you're talking about I've dealt with in other sessions, and I absolutely think you're right. I don't think this is a simplistic, I'm not trying to say that that's...
Right. No, and I'm not saying you're trying to say that. I'm just saying I just kind of come to this realization.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's the easy way to say it, but I don't know what to say.
And we're all sort of victimized by our instant gratification culture, too, and so grief is part of that. This kind of a group, when I've been talking about inviting into a healing community, just for those, I don't think most of you, I know you have, Ruth. Has anybody else also been here to give? You almost all look like new faces. Okay, just a quick piece on this then. This is the work I do, which is called a shalom group, which comes out of my own life. This has all been a whole session from before, so I'm not going to go into it in detail. But I've been in this job for a year and a half in a funeral home setting, but I very much have been a part of community groups all my life in the church community and so forth. So what this is an invitation for people. This is the little pamphlet I use in my work to hand out. And these are quotes from people of what they have found to be true of the group, and then this talks about the group. About your comment about time, which I think is right on, this is a time commitment of 8 weeks, 2 hours a session, 8 people. So that you can ensure some kind of intimacy and trust. And I was saying before to somebody out here that I feel even mildly frustrated having to do a 1 hour session, because those of you that are teachers are like to gestate a little bit in a group, you just barely can get into something in 50 minutes or an hour. And it is amazing what happens in terms of developing community and time. After 8 weeks, 2 hours a session, we've just decided we're just starting, and then every group has committed to another 8 weeks. So each of the four groups I've started has gone 16 weeks, and then we go on a retreat, and then they're meeting once a month by themselves. So what's happened is real community has been fostered out of those issues. And over and over again, how did you say the second one? Oh, we're afraid that other people's issues are going to evoke our own pain.
Yeah.
And in all videos, I've been doing a little video clip on people who have been in the groups who reflect on their experience in the group. And why I believe in this process so much is that when you're in a group, and what we do is a go-around method in a variety of ways, so everybody gets airtime to speak. And I'm not the great teacher, and I don't have all the answers and all. I don't believe in that. And people have different kinds of experiences. Amazingly, we are touched and healed and helped and scared by the issues we hear of other people's lives. Barbara Gaddy, who I had talk on the tape last week, for instance, just to quickly illustrate that, came into the group because she had a divorce 10 years ago, and right after her divorce, her father died. And she quickly stuffed it for 10 years. And so this past Christmas, she was standing at a party, Christmas party in our community, and my boss went over to her and said, "Barbara, how are you?" You know, sort of put his arm around her, and she burst into tears and she said, "I'm just terrible." And her neighbor had been going to this group and had stopped by every day and told her at the end of the session. And she said, "I knew that I was finally ready to deal with this." And so she came into the group in February, I believe, and she said that, okay, her issues of her divorce and her father's death, their whole family's been in denial for 10 years and it's caused a lot of problems. Now they're all in various ways going to therapy. But she said, "Then I hear Joe and Shirley talk about their daughter's suicide. Their daughter committed suicide in March, and I initiated to them and invited them to the group." And she said, "I am so scared. That is my worst fear, that my kid would ever commit suicide. But it's made me face my fear, and then I see how they're getting help for that. And then I hear Bernie, who's, this is so common where couples are just looking for retirement and then one will get sick and die, and her husband died just last September. And when I hear Bernie, I hear my mother. I hear some of my mother's issues." So thank you for bringing that up, because it's exactly right on. I think it's all of those things. We are afraid to deal with our own issues, and everybody that I've interviewed says, "I stuffed it, I don't want to look at it." And we have various ways of dealing with that. We're busy. We tend not to take the time for it until we're forced to. And sometimes we don't know what to say, so we don't say, and there are many more, I'm sure. Anything else that anybody wants to add?
Well, I have a friend who has just been diagnosed with cancer, and they've given her 2 months. And I went over to see Phyllis the other night before I came over here, and I just plainly told her, I said, "Phyllis, I honestly don't know what to say." You know, we sat there and talked all evening, and the one thing that came up, she said, You know, she says, I always look forward to my 65th birthday when I could get my Medicare and I won't be here to celebrate. And we sat there and just laughed, and it was just wonderful because all of a sudden, all these little things that you don't want to talk about, you don't know how anybody's going to react to them, they just flowed out, and it was just a wonderful period.
Thank you for saying that, too, because I think I often find myself saying that very thing to people in grief, that it is much better to stutter and stumble and make a fool out of yourself, you might feel you are, than to say nothing. Mm-hmm. Like Elie Wiesel says, silence is always interpreted as indifference. But to have someone come up and just say, like you said, I don't know what to say, but I really wanted you to know that I care about you, or I'm here if you want to talk, or I want to be your friend, and if you don't, and people are at different readiness stages to talk about it and to let them know that. That's a good point.
Well, I've lost two husbands. One was killed accidentally, and all I can say is I have never had such wonderful, it sounds strange to say wonderful experiences, but when my first husband was killed, the neighborhood was right there. Everybody, my church was there, and it was one gentleman who'd been working with my husband in the Boy Scout. He came over every single week, and he'd say, okay, Mama San, tell me what your week's been like. If you said it was okay, says, oh, come on, he says, Mary, now you know everything isn't okay. And he would make me sit down, and we'd sit and talk about this. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought how wonderful that was. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing with my children, too. Mm-hmm. I had three boys, and the thing that came out was that we wanted to talk about Dad. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter what came up. We'd sit and laugh about things or cry mm-hmm. about things for a long time, mm-hmm. but it worked out real well. They accepted the fact that, well, it was an accident, with mm-hmm. nobody to blame. Mm-hmm. And it was just... they were very open about talking about their father.
Thank you for bringing that up, too, because when you said this friend said, oh, come on, you know everything. That's another form, I think, of saying the subtitle for today, how is it with you? And I'll go back to the coffee hour metaphor again. I think one way we initiate gently to people when we know, if we know that they've been wounded through death, for one thing, you know, okay, it doesn't go away. And so you probably know that not everything is great and okay. So I think there are many ways we can initiate gently, like sometimes just catching someone's eye in coffee hour or being sensitive to their level of boundaries. I very much believe in the power of touch and just coming up, we'll go back to coffee hour and just touching them and say, thinking about you or something like that. And you go, oh, they know that I, you know. And you never know what will happen from that. But there are many, many ways of just gently letting people know rather than, how are you? And it's just going on. Yeah.
Sometimes the words are almost unnecessary if you have the touch. Mm-hmm. The time the president of the school where I was teaching was killed in an airline crash in Vietnam, a friend and I went into the home to answer telephones, answer the doorbell, whatever had to be done. And I was there several days, and there were so many times when Trudy just came to us to be held. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when we'd held her, a little while, she'd walk away, straightening her shoulders and go about what she had to do.
You were one of those angels. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very good point. Another one of my friends whose daughter was killed in Australia, a 25-year-old beautiful young woman who was an international travel student and all this, and she says in our group, she said that there were a couple friends like that. She's, I wasn't even aware when they came in or when they left. I was so engulfed in my own grief, but there they were. They would be sitting in my kitchen, and I thought, when did you come in? And it's that ministry of presence, of being there, and whatever you need to do.
Is it harder to deal with men in grief than mm-hmm. with women?
Well, in the sense that most men, I don't think, give themselves permission, or we haven't given them permission in our culture by the way they've been socialized, to come to groups. For instance, I have two men out of, how many have I had now, 30 people in the groups. I think that's what my opinion is. Now, why don't you men here speak for yourselves? I mean, I think that one man last week said that, I was telling this story about how when my husband's brother was killed, we were all on vacation in Colorado when it happened, so we had to go home 2 days across the prairie for a funeral. And my husband, who is a very, i.e., typical male, middle-aged man, in the sense that he has not given himself permission to cry or didn't have that permission, so he does not cry easily. I cry almost, for, like my kid said, for anything. I'll cry for everything. So I was happy to drive. I like to drive anyway. And he just wanted to, we have a station wagon, so we put the back down, and he just wanted to lay in the back and think and cry with our children. And he cried for almost 2 days. And it said it was just no effort at all. The tears just came and came and came. And this one man last week said, well, how did you feel about that? As if it would bother me. And I said, oh, it was wonderful. I think when men can cry. Now my husband, when you know, this is another thing that what happens in grief, we tend to go back after X number of months to our usual emotional pattern. So for him, it's not easy to cry. And sometimes and I'll say, oh, something about Dave, and he'll go, you know, I don't know where I put it. And yet it comes out in different ways. So sometimes what he'll say is he needs to go to Dave's grave, which will evoke his tears, and he talks to Dave there or cries there. Or sometimes something else will trigger it, but it's very difficult for him to cry. And so he'll say, I think I'm going to go for a walk and see if I can work up a cry. You know, well, I don't ever have to work up a cry. I have to work to shut it off, if anything. Anyway, about men, any of you men want to respond to that? In terms of being in a group or crying or dealing with it, is that what you're getting at, kind of dealing with?
Mm-hmm. Or, and also how to reach men who perhaps have the need, but you wouldn't be able to tell it.
Yeah. Any males here want to speak for themselves? Since I'm not a man, I'm not an expert on it. I think if I don't hear any comments, I'll just fill in what I've heard, what I've observed and read, and what all this literature says is that one little thing is that men tend to go back to work and work harder to escape it. Many of the people I deal with, and for instance, in a marriage, if there's a death of a child, the woman, sometimes the married couples don't even talk about it much. For one thing, we all grieve very differently, and since opposites tend to attract in marriages, the statistics are very high for divorce after a death of a child because we grieve differently. And men tend to work harder to avoid it and get busier, and women, whatever their emotions.
Oh, but the same token, though, knowing that you work harder at your marriage, so one
yes.
in a divorce. That's
yes.
pointed out to people very
yes,
quickly.
Yes, that's true.
The one thing you want to be very cautious of is to protect what you have
right.
until the death is passed.
Exactly. If you're resourceful enough to know that about yourself and to work at it, a lot of people aren't. yeah, that would be one issue. In terms of, let's see, what else have I noticed working with people?
Well, I was thinking of a widower whom I know, and who seems to be doing well. Just, you know, with and the way you said about not forgetting.
Mm-hmm. I think if you take the model, this is how I experience at church anyway. Every church I've ever been in or observed, most of the nurturing, education, small group sharing is by women. Now, there are men's groups in a lot of places, but by and large, that would be repeated then in grief. That pattern would be repeated.
Homophobia is what you're talking about in part, in terms of women. Women are much more able to share their grief with other women.
Mm-hmm.
Men, touching other men, for so many men, is a sign that, hey, I may not be what I thought I was.
Yes.
Homophobia gets in the way of it for a lot of men.
I've heard other men say that, too. So I think this gentleman last week said he thought that women are the ones that need to give men permission to cry. That's why he asked me if it bothered me that my husband cried. Now, I was a little surprised by that because I guess I see that it's men that need to give men permission. I don't know. Like Joe now, the dad in my couple whose daughter committed suicide, his wife said to me, and he said, I never thought I'd come to a group like this, but he hasn't missed a session. He's been there every time, and he cries. And he said, you know, I don't need to know about why Wendy did this. Right now, I can't deal with that. I don't want to know what the stages of loss and grief. I just need love. And he's just sitting like a sponge absorbing it. all these women that are in the group loving Joe, you know? And so we say, you know, Joe, if you can talk to other men and tell them what you've done, and to me that is the best way that men can give themselves permission, is to hear it from other men.
I think there's one group that needs to be watched in the kind of grief, and that is boys in the older, you know, childhood age and in early adolescence. I can remember when my brother-in-law died, we had three nephews who were about in that age of, oh, maybe 8 to 12. And they were very aware that their fathers did not cry or ever let themselves be seen crying at any rate. And I watched them grow, and I finally made a point of saying to each of these boys, you know, it's all right for a man to cry. And after that, I spent more time holding those three kids that evening of the prayer service. But somehow or other, they were convinced by then they mustn't cry, and they needed very much that kind of outlet.
Yes, good point. My own children have said, well, when you cry, it's no big deal, but when Dad cries, we know it's really something, you know, which is true. Since most of you weren't here at the last week, I'll repeat this story, but interesting little study for me when I went. Part of what I do is I'll get called to a classroom if a teacher has died to talk to the kids. And in this case, a teacher in northern Minnesota, she was like 61 and had been struggling with some chronic health problems, but no one thought she was going to die. And she was in class Monday and she died Friday. So that next Monday, I came to class to talk to the children. It turns out she was a kindergarten teacher, reading teacher for kindergarten, first, second, and third. And they wanted me to go to each class alone. So I did this presentation four times, and I didn't bring them today, but I've got wonderful children's books that I read and whatever their level, and to talk openly about it, and you go through a whole process and ritualize it, leave them some little symbols of heart and seeds to plant for new life and whatever. Well, I told the kindergarten children, you know, I said, well, you know, sometimes we need to cry. We cry when we get hurt, and brought them through that. If you're hurt, you cry. And if you've lost maybe your grandma, you'd cry maybe a lot more than for your teacher, because you've got closer to your grandma, that kind of a thing. But it's really good to cry. And how many of you think it's good for people to cry? Well, they all raise their hands. Well, how many of you think it's good for girls to cry? It's okay for boys to cry. And the kindergarten children were still wide-eyed, and like anything I'd say was probably true, you know. And by the time I got to third grade and I said that, and I said, do you know that it's really healthy for men to cry? And these boys are going, you know, rolling their eyes and going like this to each other. Yeah. It was real interesting that by then that those attitudes were real impressed. Whereas kindergarten children had a little more permission as boys, for instance.
And kind of too bad that you couldn't have had a male counterpart.
Yes, that's right. Well, I have, again, more than we have time for. It's actually almost time to end the session. Didn't have time for the tape. If you're around tomorrow and want to come back, I'm doing two more sessions before I leave on Saturday. I think I'll just save the rest of this so we don't go way over time. What this is, just briefly, and I'll talk a lot more about this tomorrow, because I'm going to talk tomorrow about the ministry of cards. I started my own card ministry doing postcards, and I brought all this because this is still what I carry around with me. And one of my addictions is calligraphy pens, and so I have this little case where I have all my pens. And then I brought a sample card to show you what I do. This is something I'm just sending to my mom with a sticker on it and a simple little message. Okay, this is how I started this whole ministry out of when we'd had the losses in my own family. And I'm not going to take more time about it. I'll tell you more about that tomorrow. And what I believe is a tremendous way to teach children this. I always say to myself, if I live to be very old, I hope that God lets me have my eyes and my right hand, because then I can keep doing this even if I'm 95 years old and I've lost everything else, because this is what gives me a lot of joy. So I'll talk about that tomorrow. But I'm going to close this session by highlighting this book, which is not in the bookstore because this is the only one left, and I'm just carting it around to show. This is the book I had ordered for my teaching sessions, and I should have told them to order 100 copies because it's so good. I found this book here last year at Holden, and this is the book that I use in the Shalom groups that I lead. So if any of you like books and like to get down titles, I highly recommend this. It's Helping People Through Grief. And part of what I always do when I do presentations and this kind of work is to encourage people that maybe you're the person in your parish that could start a group like this. You don't have to be a therapist. You don't have to be. You don't have to think you know everything under the sun about grief. You don't have to know all the answers. But you could lead a book discussion group on this book, which is a way of getting it on the educational agenda of a parish. And this is written by a woman who is no stranger to grief herself, and each chapter has a specialized kind of grief. Now, I'm talking about only through death. This is SIDS, suicide, death of a spouse, death of a child, divorce, even murder is in here. The only thing, major issues that aren't in here are incest and AIDS. But I'll leave it up here if any of you want to take a look at it. But the bookstore has more on order, but I don't know when they're coming in. But if you want to find a wonderful book. And then I'm going to just close by reading this little thing. This is a book of, it's called Book of Qualities, and qualities are personified. And I think this is an appropriate way to end today's session. And if you want to stay around informally, we can continue talking. Compassion wears Saturn's rings on the fingers of her left hand. She is intimate with the life force. She understands the meaning of sacrifice. She is not afraid to die, and there is nothing you cannot tell her. Compassion speaks with a slight accent. She was a vulnerable child, miserable in school, cold, shy, alert to the pain in the eyes of her sturdier classmates. The other kids teased her about being too sentimental, and for a long time she believed them. In ninth grade, she was befriended by Courage. Courage lent Compassion bright sweaters, explained the slang, showed her how to play volleyball, and taught her that you can love people and not care what they think about you. In many ways, Compassion is still the stranger, neither wonderful nor terrible, herself utterly always. And I love that idea that she's compassionate because she'd had a lot of pain herself in childhood, but she was befriended by Courage. So, we'll officially end, but if any of you want to stay around, we can talk about whatever you want to talk about.